everyone, and welcome back to another episode here at the Damage Report. Today is Tuesday. Tuesdays aren't like Wednesdays. Wednesdays are big news days. Tuesdays don't really have a theme. Like Mondays, you're sad because you're back in the week. Wednesday, oh my God, there's big news. Tuesday, I'm starting to think maybe it's just weird news because we got a lot of weird news for you. We have some of the weirdest videos we've played on the show in quite a while coming up. But that's not the only weird thing we have. We also have the return of the professor, Quay Gordon, back on the show. How's it going, Quay?
What's up, John? How you doing? Good to be back.
I'm glad to have you back. So many people probably remember you from your past appearances. I mean, you've been a guest since basically the show began. You're a psychologist. Tell people sort of what your research focus is, because we've got some stories that actually play into what you've worked on.
Sure. Most of my research focuses on masculinity, gender, sexuality, things like that. I've also been doing a lot research recently into personality, which we've talked about on this show a couple times.
Exactly. Yeah, I think the last time you were on, we talked about Myers-Briggs, I think, a little bit.
That's right.
Exactly. Importantly, we also play on the same Valheim server, so we have a lot of cross interest in and out of politics. So feel free to comment about that. Anyway, and also we've been friends for a really very long time. Played volleyball together, so it's always good to have you here, especially to talk about the news of the day.
That's right. Good to be here again.
Thank you everybody for watching, regardless of where you are. If you're on, you know, Twitch or on YouTube, on the members app, Twitter, anything like that. Thank you for watching as always, especially in this time of algorithmic chaos on YouTube. Please hit the like button and share the stream if you haven't already, so the people know we're live. And while we're going through these stories, and it is a lot of stories that we've got on the docket for today, if you want to send us comments or tweets or super chats or anything like that, questions, concerns, Quay and I will respond to those between the topics. But with that, you ready to do this, Quay?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's do it. Major news recently, that stimulus bill passed. You know, we're still waiting for a signature, but it's now passed the Senate. It's huge, by the way, a couple trillion dollars. Seems like it would be big news. Seems like, since it's the Dems that passed it, the right, you know, they're the resistance now, they'd be interested in talking about it. But the weird thing is that they're not really. Like, I'm gonna show you a video. This is really, I think, a fair representative sample of what the right was talking about as this massive piece of legislation was cruising to victory. Take a look.
Alone, we have seen Kermit the Frog, Mr. Potato Head, Dr. Seuss, Star Wars characters, pancake syrup, butter, and beloved sports teams logos banned. Erased from history. These are not simply marketing choices of private companies. We want to emphasize this. Joe Biden's White House endorses these modern day book burnings. The White House, the most powerful seat in our land. Biden broke with long-standing tradition and refused to acknowledge Dr. Seuss on his birthday this very week. He refused to recommend that children read beloved Dr. Seuss books. Amazon then stopped selling certain Dr. Seuss titles and publishers halted printing them entirely. Here are real screenshots from an eBay user getting blocked for trying to sell a Dr. Seuss book because it is, and I quote, offensive material. We verified these images are real. What's also real, real shocking, is that Hitler's Mein Kampf is still available for sale on eBay. This is a book literally about racism. This is a book literally calling for book burnings. You cannot make this up.
And we confirmed that you can still purchase Mein Kampf. I purchased additional copies. But anyway, yeah. Look, this is not a thing where we're gonna talk a ton about Dr. Seuss. If Quay wants to talk about it, he hasn't been on, feel free. But that's really what's been going on really fast. If you go to Matthew Gertz of Media Matters for America, he did a compilation of all of the front pages of major right-wing news sites when the bill passed. And I want you to take a look at this. Some of these are stories. You know, Breitbart had Governor Cuomo's troubles up. Biden uses feds to push cheat by mail. Some of it's about Meghan Markle or about China. Some of it is arguably news, which is good. But I think you could have a mention of this major bill. So we're gonna debate a little bit why it is that they're focusing on the things that they are and not things that seem objectively like big news. But first of all, Quay, any thoughts on the Dr. Seuss?
Not on the Dr. Seuss thing, perhaps, but maybe just kind of getting into the question that you're asking, which is, you know, I really just kind of see this as anymore, it's sort of an us versus them thing. We've basically made red team, blue team, and the red team can't admit when the blue team is doing something good, or they at least just don't want to show it when the blue team is doing something good. And a little bit vice versa when Trump was president. You know, I'm sure there were some Democrats that had to bite their lips when something good was done, or something that we agreed with, like prison, that piece of prison reform. So I really just think it's kind of an us versus them thing, an in-group, out-group. And, you know, the Republicans anymore, or conservatives, if you like, aren't gonna admit when something good is going on. They just don't have it in them.
Well, I'm sorry, in addition to the us versus them, it's about to be me versus you. Because the thing is, when like previous stimulus bills passed under Trump, we covered it. Like, it seemed important. It's still trillions of dollars. It just seems so weird.
Am I doing the both sides thing here?
No. Look, and your point is obviously true. Not of us. We ascend past all of these sorts of comparisons. But other lesser humans who crawl through the muck. But anyway, I get what you're saying. But here's the thing, Quay. I'm not even asserting that it's weird that Newsmax isn't like all hail Biden for his fabulous legislation. They're not even really like attacking it. Like, normally they would come up with some BS way to attack it. And to be fair, some have. Tucker Carlson did a whole segment about how it's expensive. Yeah, it's expensive. The last one was too. He did the old college try of attacking it, but most of them don't even care to do that. And one reason possibly for that is that, according to recent polling, 69% of voters support the bill. And apparently that includes 84% of Democrats, 65% of independents, and 54% of Republicans. When you actually break down what's in it, it's overwhelmingly positive. The grants to small businesses have an 83% approval rating. Stimulus checks are at 78%. Funding to help schools reopens at 75%. Extensions to unemployment benefits are at 71%. So maybe this is just it's like we would love to play resistance to this, but it seems pretty positive. So maybe we're just gonna back down and not draw attention to it.
I mean, I think that's it. They're sort of painted in a corner if they want to report on it, in the sense that, you know, if it's good and the public thinks it's good, then what can they say, right? Again, they probably don't want to, or don't have it in them to say something positive. And I'm talking about these more conservative news agencies. So why not just talk about it? You know, I sometimes, when I'm watching you guys or MSNBC or even CNN, I'll flip on Fox News just to see, like, what can they possibly be saying about this? What's the negative spin? And more often than not, when it is something that's really just overwhelmingly positive, they're not talking about it. They're talking about, you know, whatever it is that gets their viewers riled up.
Yeah. And well, I guess vice versa too, when it's something that it would be difficult to really mount a defense for, like, the impeachment trial, the second one, they didn't really play much of that. The attacks on the Capitol, they largely ignored that as it was going on. When they had time to step back and come up with some sort of evasion or defense, they'll then talk about it, but live, not so much. But really fast, I want to read a tweet that I saw going around this morning from Eric Erickson, who's a Republican. I believe he's mostly anti-Trump. He's one of like the never Trump Republicans. That might have changed, God only knows. I don't really pay that much attention to what he says or thinks, but I found this to be a really interesting tweet and really revelatory, possibly accidentally. He tweeted, "I know a lot of smart people out there are saying the GOP was so focused on Dr. Seuss that they couldn't mount effective opposition to the COVID plan. I think they need to learn what I've started learning. More voters will remember Seuss when they vote than the COVID plan." And look, we can debate, is that true or not? Do we think that, whether he's talking about voters broadly or conservative voters specifically, do you think he is right that more will remember this cancel culture stuff than who passed unemployment insurance and stimulus bills and all of that? That they'll forget that Biden sent them a check because Biden killed Seuss?
Well, I'm not sure. Let me say this. Republicans, you know, are great at branding. You know, they are head and shoulders above Democrats when it comes to just naming things, mm-hmm. such that, you know, they have to say, oh, you're against the Patriot Act, or you're against, you know, things that sound really good. And so I also think that they're pretty good at picking out issues that aren't necessarily important, but are memorable, are maybe important in a sentimental way, right? I grew up on Dr. Seuss and my mom used to read this to me, and how dare you, right? And so I think that that's what they're going for. And in that way, they may be right. I think if it's the kind of thing where that check comes and goes, and, you know, at the next election cycle or whenever it's important again, Republicans, you know, or really just the people will say, hey, I don't really remember that. I'm still hurting. I still need this. I still need that. I think if it's a piece of a package that keeps us moving forward and people are better by the time we get to an election or another important, even just media cycle, I think that'll be a different case. But I think if it's just a drop in the bucket and 3 months from now, 2 years from now, folks are still suffering, I think they're not going to remember it. But they will be able to say, oh, yeah, they canceled Dr. Seuss, which they didn't, of course, but that's the story.
Which they didn't, they weren't involved. All of the books that people are like, hey, I love Dr. Seuss's insert blank book that is still going to be published. Nobody read the ones that are not being. Anyway, we're not going to relitigate all of that. Yeah, I look, my only other thought on this to Eric Erickson, I would say, whether you are right or not, and especially if you are, you think that this is true of the conservative voters. Doesn't that worry you at all? That, like, what if you're right? Isn't there something messed up about that? That people would be more focused on a private company deciding to pull publication of a bunch of books that nobody had ever thought about than about COVID aid or dealing with the pandemic and that sort of thing? I'm really not even sure that he's wrong. I would also say, how is that working out for you? That you've produced this conservative electorate that only cares about this nonsense. Is it working out for you in the special elections? How did Trump do? How about 2018 when the House flipped? How about the fact that Republicans have won one popular vote in the presidential race in like going on 2 decades? Does this seem like a good thing for your party? Now, they've managed to maintain hold on quite a bit of power thanks to some of the structural inequities baked into our constitution, but it doesn't seem like it's a great thing for the Republicans. So maybe he's able to identify it. Maybe it would be a good idea to push back against it a little bit and say, hey, maybe it'd be a good thing if we stress the importance of dealing with economic issues to our voters and got them thinking about it a little bit more. Maybe if we had a right-wing media that actually talked about these sorts of things rather than just Dr. Seuss and the Muppets or whatever. But I sort of doubt that that's gonna happen anytime soon.
Well, I see two terrible things as happening right now. I mean, I don't know if this is terrible, but it just looks bad at least, which is, you know, saying those quiet parts out loud. I think probably Democratic public politicians as well, but certainly Republican politicians, of kind of just saying the outright indefensible political thing, right? I'm doing this to get votes, or I'm doing this to, you know, not allow this group of people to vote or whatever it is, or to just defeat my opponent. I feel like that type of stuff used to be hidden a little bit, at least outside of the campaign. It used to be hidden that, you know, you're not just doing things to defeat your opponent, you're doing things to help your constituents. And I feel like some of that has been lost. And the other thing is, and I mean, this has been going on for a while, and it's almost a problem inherent in democracy if it's not addressed, which is to say, this kind of populism, which is letting the people kind of dictate what the leadership is doing rather than the leader saying, hey, this is what's important, this is what we need to focus on, right? Speaking to your constituents rather than just kind of reacting to every whim that they have. Mm-hmm. I think we're missing leadership in many areas of our government.
I'm predisposed to agree with you there.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
From the very beginning, Laura Ingraham has been worried about misinformation being spread about the coronavirus. And up till today, last night, she had this section. We're not going to show you the video, by the way. I wouldn't do that to you. But here's a screenshot from her show with the lower third, COVID 1 year later, what the experts got wrong. Time to retire the control freaks. She has been so focused on misinformation that she has decided to spread a bunch of it. She was like the original hydroxychloroquine person, by the way. She apparently took a trip to the White House. She was the person that got Trump obsessed with it. She later tweeted that it had a Lazarus-like effect on one person who was severely. How did that work out? We all going down to CVS to get shots of hydroxychloroquine, Laura Ingraham? No, but anyway, she's super worried about the misinformation. So to that end, we're gonna spread a little bit of the new information about what the CDC says fully vaccinated people can do. Before we get into the specifics though, Quay, I've been fascinated to try to figure out when people think they're gonna get vaccinated, when things will be back to normal. What are your thoughts about that? How excited are you? When do you think it's likely to happen?
Oh man, you know, living the dream, I guess, but I feel like it's the type of thing that's right now become so baked in, you know, it's become normal now. You know, thinking about a year ago, wearing masks, 6 feet apart, you know, can't go out. I think, you know, folks were freaking out and, you know, making big changes in their life. I feel like anymore, it's been a year, you know, it really only takes, you know, 2-3 months to make a habit. So it's been a whole year. I feel like people have gotten used to it. And so, I mean, those folks were, you know, adhering from the start, or at least somewhere soon thereafter. So I feel like, you know, when this happens, it's not going to be this immediate, like everybody goes back to normal. I think some people are going to be really eager to kind of go back to normal, stop wearing masks, go out, visit folks. I think other folks will come on a little bit later, or maybe take some half steps. I'll wear a mask here, but not there. And I imagine some folks are, you know, really going to be scared to go out and are probably going to keep wearing masks for quite a long time just in public. I think it is probably that thing, at least, is going to be the type of thing that we're going to see probably for the future.
Yeah, I expect it. I wonder when seeing unmasked people in tight TV scenes will feel normal again. That still weirds me out. But yeah, and so look, I get it. And I think one of the things that makes people nervous is not knowing for sure what's okay or not. So we want to make sure that people have the most updated information about what the CDC recommends. Not because the CDC is God himself and knows for sure, but they actually seem to care about knowing it, unlike people like Laura Ingraham. So as of right now, as more and more people, something like 2.2 million vaccine doses in the US are being administered every day. What effect will that have on your life? So according to the CDC, their new guidance, fully vaccinated people can visit other vaccinated people indoors without masks or physical distancing. So that's good. They can visit indoors with unvaccinated people from a single household without masks or physical distancing if the unvaccinated people are low risk for severe disease. They can skip quarantine and testing if exposed to someone who has COVID-19 but are asymptomatic, but should monitor for symptoms for 14 days. So basically, once everyone has it, you're pretty good, at least for small groups, and you're less likely to spread it, but it doesn't mean that you don't have to watch for symptoms. People who are vaccinated can still get it, even if generally, even once they get it, it's going to be a far less severe case. So bear that in mind. They also say that fully vaccinated people must wear a mask and keep good physical distance around the unvaccinated who are at increased risk for severe COVID-19. Or if the unvaccinated person has a household member who is at higher risk, they must wear masks and physically distance when visiting unvaccinated people who are from multiple households. So this is gonna blow people's minds. If you're around a person who's likely to die if they get COVID, don't possibly give them COVID. That is still gonna be the advice. And if you're gathering in a big group, it's still a pandemic. You're still gonna have to wear a mask. You're still gonna have to social distance. And I would add, whether that's necessary medically, and it appears that it is, like if I go somewhere with a lot of people, Quay, I may know that I have the vaccine, but they don't know that. And the thing is, like, I could tell people that I have it, but we have people that are arguing with servers at Panera about their supposed medical reasons they can't wear a mask. Are you really gonna trust people who just blurt out, oh, don't worry, I have the vaccine? Like, for the purposes of not freaking people out, as well as possibly not still giving them COVID, we're probably gonna have to wear masks in public at least for a good while.
Yeah, I think so. And I think in line with that, what's also possibly going on in terms of those guidelines is the continued normalcy of wearing a mask for folks who can't get vaccinated yet or just won't get vaccinated. That here's the thing, that we're still doing this, right? And that it's still normal to do this. And even if you're vaccinated, that doesn't mean, stop, obviously, for contagion reasons. But I also think there's kind of this mass psychological thing going on. If you think about how long it sort of took to onboard everybody, and still not everybody in the country, to kind of adhere to these guidelines, I think they're being careful not to take too many steps forward and throw everything out the window. So that other people see that we're still doing this, but also, of course, to be careful. Things can still be transmissible, and we gotta be safe.
Yeah, and they specifically point out that some places, like social activities, like going to the gym or the restaurant, you do have a lower risk of infection, but you should still take precautions. Again, medical precautions, and also just sort of social, like just to reassure people, if nothing else. One thing that they did say that I think might surprise people is their new recommendations have not changed for travel. The CDC says people should delay travel and stay home, which I'm sure for some people who live far away from their family possibly, or just really into travel or have business needs to travel, that is gonna be disappointing. I will say that back in the before times, Quay and I often used to meet up. That hasn't happened in a long time. It looks like we might have to wait a little bit longer, buddy.
So sad. We can't do our Valheim LARPing like we planned. Go chop trees.
That's not true. It does sound fun though. Actually, we're gonna have someone attempting to chop down a tree a little bit later on in the show, albeit slowly. But anyway, before we get to that, we do have some weird news to get to. So let's transition to this next one. In Harry and Meghan Markle's interview with Oprah just a couple of days ago, one of the most shocking lines was when Meghan Markle said that apparently one of the members of the royal family had brought up to Harry concerns about the skin color potentially of her children. So that's horrible. But what if it's also untrue? Someone who I definitely trust for evaluations of racism is Ben Shapiro. And here's his theory on that particular little factoid.
Okay, so then Meghan Markle starts talking about how difficult, she starts talking about how racist everyone was. And she relates a conversation in which apparently somebody asked how dark her son's skin would be. Now, this would be an excellent time for Oprah, being the interviewer, to ask, okay, can you name a name? I mean, that would be, if someone says something as overtly racist as, how dark is your son's skin going to be? First of all, what kind of stupid, I'm just gonna say it, I don't believe that happened. I don't think that happened. Honest to God, I don't think it happened. The reason I don't think that happened is because no one says anything like that. That's a ridiculous question. How dark is your son's skin gonna be? And like, beyond like the racism of it, the actual stupidity, like the human stupidity of having to ask that question. Do you not know what biracial children look like? Like that's a, what? Because I don't believe this for a second, but here she is saying a thing I don't, plus she's a, maybe it's true and she's such a bad actress that I can't even tell that it's true. That's possible.
Okay, so first of all, if you are gonna accuse us of speeding up the video, I swear that we didn't. That's actually what it looks and sounds like anyway. So Quay, we talk about this because of course he's very influential and he is one of those on the right that is a massive apologist for racism, which comes in a couple different forms. One of the most common ones is it just doesn't happen. Nobody has those beliefs. Nobody actually says those things. And in this case, Quay, I mean, nobody could say something that is at the same time both racist and dumb, surely.
I think you can't not say something both racist and dumb. Well, you know, I'm thinking a couple things. You know, one, this is a common thing that I feel like people of color, women, sexual minorities go through whenever they mention that something happened to them or might have happened to them that was racist or bigoted in whatever way. Is that they get asked to prove it, you know? Mm-hmm. And in this case, this isn't them being put on trial or, you know, it's a due process thing. It's I'm sharing my feelings. I'm sharing what happened to me. I'm sharing my experience, you know, living in this country in this role that, you know, is so strange for most people, especially and uniquely if you're a person of color. And so for Ben Shapiro to sort of come at that interview with this kind of prove it mentality or, you know, say more, or name the name, you know, it's pretty typical. And I feel like it's just insensitive to what was happening in that moment. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, and, you know, this is just my opinion, as is everything I say here. I think that we have to stop letting white people use their feelings as the arbiter of whether or not racism has occurred, right? This idea that it didn't feel racist to me, or I didn't see that racism, or who would ever say something like that? Well, that's not your lived experience. You know, that's nobody's going to say that to you in particular. So of course you haven't heard that. And of course it seems unrealistic, but this idea that Ben Shapiro, of all people, of all white people, would be saying, you know, that doesn't feel like something somebody would say, I feel like is pretty ridiculous on the face of itself. Mm-hmm. And I think is a bad lesson for how racism should be met. And it's not even always that, you know, when somebody is describing something that they feel like may have been racist, I tell my students all the time, the most, you know, powerful privilege that folks have, whether it be gender or race or, you know, sexuality, is not having to question, not having to worry about whether or not the things that are happening to them are due to their race, gender, whatever the identity, yeah, right? That you don't have to question these interactions in that way. You can generally be sure that what's happening to you is due to, you know, some individual characteristic or something that you set up yourself. Folks of color, women, all these other minorities don't necessarily have that in all situations. And here, I think you see Megan, you know, she's saying something that if somebody says that, that's overtly racist. But whether or not, whether even if it was insinuated, whether or not that was the feeling she got, not to doubt her, what she's saying there, but even if that's just the feeling, it's not appropriate, I think, really, for Ben Shapiro, of all people, to say, well, I don't think that happened.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah, and yeah, well, you're a writer, so you know that every scene should accomplish at least two objectives. And so what I love is that it's very efficient what we just saw there. He is simultaneously saying that racism doesn't exist because it would be stupid. He's also leading his audience that's probably 99% white in like just loving to hate this lying black woman. Like, right. But racism doesn't exist. Right. So one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about this, though, was I don't know exactly what it is that I'm sort of trying to identify, this new strain in the right wing that I've seen now on him. I've seen it in Tucker Carlson. I've seen it in Laura Ingraham, where they are denying a thing exists to their audience that is far more likely on average to be a part of that thing or believe that thing. And let me define what I mean. So he's saying racism doesn't exist to an audience that knows what they think about black people. Like they may not want to think about it too much. And so it's convenient to have someone like Ben Shapiro say racism doesn't exist. If it does, you don't have to worry about it. But other examples include Tucker Carlson doing a whole section on his show saying We looked for QAnon online and couldn't find its website. QAnon doesn't exist. Even though many people in his audience believe in QAnon. Laura Ingraham did the same thing. Like, they're watching this show being told by someone they trust implicitly that a thing doesn't exist, that they themselves associate with, and seemingly this doesn't cause any sort of cognitive distress to them. They seem to almost like it, and I don't understand what is being done here, what the purpose psychologically of this sort of misinformation or manipulation of your audience that they seem to like. I just don't understand what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for me, it feels like a bit of, you know, kind of classic politics mixed with dog whistles, right? Because the classic politics piece is, I feel like the folks watching that are saying, yeah, good thing to say, that'll throw them off. Like, it's kind of a play, right? What, that was a good play. Whether or not it's true, is this going to anger the left or lead them astray or give us some cover for our feelings, you know, conscious or unconscious? And so I think, you know, there's that piece. And then the dog whistle of, we're talking about this, we're saying nasty things about, you know, Black folks, people of color, women, we're saying them, but we're just saying it about this particular person. So it's not racist. And meanwhile, we're also denying racism. So good play, right? And so it's this kind of weird mental gymnastics where they're having their cake and eating it too, right? They're getting to call out, you know, I was just thinking today, I mean, I hope I don't go on too much of a tangent, but I was just thinking today, right? All of the like conservative villains are women and people of color. Like, even Joe Biden isn't really a villain.
Generally.
But Kamala Harris is, right?
And so and Hillary was, yeah.
They get to sort of pick and choose these very particular minorities that they go after, while at the same time saying, no, but we like, you know, we like this particular Black person, or we like this particular woman who's spouting our points. So I don't know. It's a weird conundrum, but they do seem to enjoy it. I agree.
It's weird, and I'm sure I'm probably putting too much mental effort into something that either doesn't matter or isn't interesting, so I apologize. But like, it would be, I'm trying to come up with like an example of what if I were to do something like this. Like, it would be one thing if I were to tell my audience, knowing what I know about the audience, if I were to lie to them about something and says it's not there, that might be true of them. So for instance, if I were to say this idea that any leftist could be misogynistic or racist, it's not true. I can understand why someone in my position might lie to the audience, because first of all, there are definitely leftists who are misogynistic and are racist, but that's uncomfortable. You might want to pretend that that's not true. I get that. But it would be like if I told my audience, nobody wants to cancel student loan debt, no progressive wants that, no progressive wants Medicare for all, but you are watching it and you want that. Like, why am I lying to you about something you know is true and that you like? That's, it's true. Like, I'm sure that there's many people who aren't racist that think, well, I bet most racists are really ashamed about it. And maybe some racists are ashamed about it, but some are not ashamed about it. For some of them, it is their favorite thing about themselves that they are racist. So I don't know. The whole thing just blows my mind constantly.
Well, you know, I'm sure this is true of Democrats too, and I feel like I've been talking about conservatives a lot. I love conservative people. They, you know, they have great barbecues, and I'm from the South, so
let's spit up my coffee.
But I think, I don't know, there's some sort of like mental gymnastics that has to happen. You know, if you want to talk Freudian psychology, or for the ego to feel sated, right? That if you believe on any level that racism or sexism or locking children in cages or, you know, keeping out asylum seekers, like if you believe on any level that that is wrong, right? If you believe that those things are immoral or unethical in some ways, but you also in some way don't want those people here. Maybe it's tribalism or racism or whatever it is, but somewhere inside of you, you have this kind of tension. Well, now you need to figure out a way to want what you want, which is to keep those people out, but also entertain this more sophisticated part of yourself that knows that those things are uncouth and uncivil. And so I think you get this weird mixed upness. And I think some folks, you know, in particular, maybe the people in power kind of know that they're playing both hands, right? That they're, you know, saying one thing and feeling another or wanting another. It was really stark to me, a little tangent, when they were voting on Liz Cheney and what's her name in the Republican caucus. By private vote, and it was reasonable when they did the private vote, and it wasn't like, oh, kick out Liz Cheney and, you know, elevate this other woman. It was relatively reasonable because they got to hide behind, you know, nobody has to see that I said this or want this. So I don't know. I just think a lot of conservatives or Republicans, in many cases, and I'm sure Democrats too, are really mixed up in how they feel. And I think maybe on a deep psychological level, like, you know, not like, you know, you need therapy because you've got a mental disorder, but because you got some stuff you need to untangle.
Yeah.
And otherwise, I think they're just trying to do their best in terms of, I believe this, but I feel this. And so I'm going to watch Tucker Carlson tell me how I can do both.
I agree. Yeah. Well, and especially like my belief is that a lot of people in media, the one skill they have is knowing more about what their audience members want and need than the audience members do, like in manipulating that to generate money. So yeah, I think that there's like, this is one of the reasons I want you on the show all the time, is because I think you get that and you can speak to that in a way that most don't even acknowledge. I don't know what problem new Congressman Madison Cawthorn has with trees, but at least he's trying to work it out in a weird way. Take a look at this video that he had apparently posted and since has taken down from a couple of years ago. So, Quay, I wanted to make sure that you commented on this because I don't know how familiar you are with Madison Cawthorn. Are you familiar with this representative? Okay, well, you're about to.
Yes, I've seen him before, yeah.
Okay, so for people who might not know, though, let's see. He has, he apparently, I feel so uncomfortable even acknowledging this, but he has apparently lied about the tragedy that took his ability to walk away. He lied about his education history. He apparently was so well known as a sexual harasser and predator at college that all of the women at the college knew not to be alone with him. And he has denied all of that. Just an awful guy. He took this weird trip to Adolf Hitler's bunker and, like, in a social media post, referred to him as the Führer. You can start to put together some of these things. So anyway, he wants to be a tough guy. Like, he's one of the guys, Quay, that triggers the libs. I assume that's what's going on here, is that that's supposed to be masculine.
I just want to be careful, you know, so I'm not diagnosing anybody or, you know.
No diagnosis.
Necessarily even commenting on this particular individual. But what I see there is sort of a classic superiority complex, right? Which is to say, somebody who poses superiority as a way, or projects superiority as a way to defend against a felt inferiority, right? And guys really tend to do this very often in a sort of hyper masculine kind of way. Freud called this castration anxiety.
Oh.
And so it's just this idea about sort of losing one's manhood, losing one's power. And so having to overemphasize that. The kind of classic example is the guy in the big truck, right? Or the, you know, the short guy who is always trying to pick fights. So I don't wanna, you know, comment on his sort of physical condition there, but you can imagine somebody who has a disability that kind of interrupts perhaps how people see them in terms of their strength and their power, perhaps interrupts how people see them in terms of their sexuality, in terms of their romantic viability, right? That this type of person might need to prove, or feel the need to overtly prove how strong and powerful he is. So
Yeah, I don't know a lot about the guy. I think it's just a right wing thing.
But I would say that's what might be going on.
I get what you're saying. I think I could imagine this being Ted Cruz when he was younger. I could imagine this being almost any right winger. And I would go so far as to say that they've all done it. They just haven't necessarily posted. It's the posting of it that's the most interesting thing. It's not that you did it. It's that you filmed it and then you made it public online, which turns it from a thing you're doing to a thing you want people to see you're doing, which is a little bit weird. And so at that point, because it's not like, you know, this was taken off of his phone or something. At that point, I then have to evaluate what message you're trying to send. And then I have to take that message and compare it to what you're really doing. So if the message is, look at me being intimidating or whatever, well then at that point I have to point out that you apparently found the most rotted half standing tree in the entire forest to punch, which is a little bit weird. I watched Bloodsport growing up. I've watched the Rocky movies. I get the idea of punching a tree. They weren't punching trees that were half dead at the point.
Sure.
And the thing is, again, this isn't even really about him. I don't really care about Madison Cawthorn. He will inevitably take himself down with saying incredibly racist stuff and stuff like that. That's coming in like a year. For me, it's that why do right wingers have to do all of this performative masculine BS? I don't get the need. And more importantly, I don't understand why it's appealing to their voters. Why their voters want to see them shoot a bill in a campaign ad or cook bacon on their gun as if that has anything to do with Ted Cruz. I just don't get any of that stuff. Sure. And I definitely don't think it's good for America.
Well, I don't know. So for one, it's just cultural in some ways, right? It is the same as, and you're already saying this, right? All of the gun ads, all of these, you know, that politicians use where they'll, you know, have a gun or be shooting something or whatever it is. There is something, the Republican Party is a more masculine party, I think if you can say. And they play into that role, you know, as much as they can. I think their voters like it. I think certainly in the South, I know that plays. We both lived in Texas. You know that's going to play in Texas, mm-hmm. right? That sort of gun-toting, you know, kick-ass, big truck, this guy is going to play well in Texas. So there is that kind of cultural piece that's going on. The need to show it, right? The man who has to say, I am the king, right? The need to mm-hmm. show it is a different thing. But I think that's a psychological thing. As much as it is a political play, right? I need to show my voters how tough I am. And you think about guys like, I mean, there are some tough guys in Congress, right? Ex-Marines, ex-military, these type of guys. They rarely do that type of thing unless they're old and they're trying to show I used to be in the whatever. But it's usually the guys who are a little, well, more nerdy, like Ted Cruz, right? or folks who have to kind of prove, hey, I'm one of the tough guys too. So I think that's what the play is. Is they're trying to sort of acculturate themselves as a piece of that masculine Southern conservative heritage.
I think you're mostly right. Like, I think for someone like Ted Cruz, there's more of a need to do it. But look, Dan Crenshaw served in the military and he still put together the cringiest campaign ad fake action movie ever. So there's more of enough of that to go around.
Interesting.
Anyway, really fast, I wanted to read one great tweet I saw in response to the post about this video from Dawn, who said, great metaphor for Republicans, find the weakest thing you can, in this case, a skinny dead tree, and then relentlessly beat it to show how tough you are. Videotape yourself. Meanwhile, big healthy trees that deserve attention and continue to thrive. Pick your own stand-ins for trees. Which I think is pretty good. Also, yeah. What does he have against the Lorax?
Does he ever get the tree down?
It was good. If he had punched it, it would have fallen down in an hour. Anyway, my only point is, where's Treebeard when you need him? Third of all, I did want to provide a little bit of advice for the next taping of something like this. It was a perfectly fine effort by Madison Cawthorn, but there are some people, and people have alluded to this in the chat, who have a little bit more skill in this area. Take a look at this video. Is a very scary little girl that apparently is training for boxing and very much knows what she's doing. Can you imagine if that trunk was your torso?
Was that birch? That fine wood's hard to punch through.
Shut up. Anyway, yeah, by the way, somebody pointed out all Madison Cawthorn was doing was trying to get wood in rust, punching down the trees like Minecraft. But that little girl, that is intimidating, man. She knows what she's doing. God, she is putting all of her weight into that thing. And that tree is not half dead. I mean, it will be in a second, but when she came to it, it wasn't half dead. Jesus, that's scary. That's gonna haunt my dreams now. Anyway, okay. What's that?
She should run for Congress.
Exactly. I think she's actually Russian, but perhaps at some point. Oh. Anyway, she'll be the person that finally takes down Putin. Quay, I think that we're getting too close to the end of the hour for this next topic. And I know that you have a class, so I should probably let you go.
Is it just one? I have class at two. I mean, got another.
Oh, you got time?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll jump into this. You give me a secret signal if we go too far and you need to duck out, okay?
Okay, I'll figure it out.
Okay, in that case, we're gonna roll right into this then. Following terrible election losses, the Republicans had a choice to make. Could they actually support some policies that the majority of Americans support and would thus vote for Republicans for? That's too difficult. They found something else they can do, and that is try to stop as many people from voting as possible. And so, although there is no evidence of systemic fraud in the recent elections, lawmakers in 43 states are debating about 200 bills that would limit ballot access, according to the Brennan Center for Justice, a public policy group. Now, we've talked about this multiple times over the past couple of weeks. We've also given you updates on a couple of the particular bills that were most likely to pass and were the most egregious. And now, regrettably, we have to give you the update on a couple because they have actually passed. And so let's take a look at Iowa, where Governor Kim Reynolds on Monday signed into law a Republican-backed bill that makes it harder to vote early, potentially eroding a key aspect of Democratic campaigns. Could have been Republican campaigns too, but they decided to turn against early voting for some reason rather than just getting Republicans to vote early too. Anyway. Republicans in the House and Senate quickly approved the voting changes over the opposition of all Democratic legislators. Republicans said the new rules were needed to guard against voting fraud, though they noted Iowa has no history of election irregularities and that November's election saw record turnout with no hint of problems in the state. The law shortens the early voting period to 20 days from the current 29, just 3 years after Republicans reduced the period from 40 days, so it's now half of what it was. It also requires most mail ballots to be received by election day rather than counting votes postmarked by election day that arrive by noon of the Monday following the election. Voting sites will close at 8 rather than 9 because, as everyone knows, voting fraud happens between 8 and 9. So they thankfully cut that off. That makes sense. And county election officials are banned from sending out absentee ballot request forms unless requested. They also do some stuff to satellite voting sites and a lot of other things, Quay. But basically, they are attempting to cut back on as many of the areas where more voting has been generated in recent elections.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's just wild anymore. And it, again, it's that type of thing that seems pretty clear on the face of itself what's going on. And yet, saying the quiet piece out loud that nobody really would care to stop it. So I really don't know what to say about that. I mean, it's horrible. Mm-hmm. I really think that we should be pushing for a national holiday, election holiday, at least once every 2 years kind of a thing, if not every year. And that's not necessarily going to stop these states from doing what they're doing. But I think it puts a little more pressure that this is kind of a national culture, or this is, you know, the culture of a country that, hey, you know, we're off on election day so that people have the ability to vote.
I think it's a great idea. Yeah, it wouldn't help with quite a few of these state level things, but it would at least give people a fighting chance on election day, especially those who are potentially struggling with multiple jobs, with long hours and can't get away to actually vote. It would certainly help with that. And it is possible that setting up some sort of democracy day, which I've been pushing for years, could generate a conversation nationally, right, about the state of American democracy, who is defending it and who is assaulting it. And it would be just one part of what would be necessary. But I think it could help. I think that it's long past due that we've had that conversation. And the thing about Iowa is, Like, I get that they're trying to do this stuff in Georgia, and we're gonna talk about Georgia in a little bit. In Iowa, Trump won by 9 points. 9 points. Like, they were already gonna win. I mean, I know years passed in Iowa, it was close, right, or whatever. Like, it seems almost unnecessary in Iowa to do this. Like, in Georgia, sure, you lost by just a little bit, so you wanna screw those people over to win. It's not even determining the winner in Iowa. It's almost like, well, if other places are doing it, we want to get in on the fun. Sure. We want to stop some votes.
Flex. It's a bit of a flex, right? You know, just like, hey, look how cool we've got our voters suppressed.
Exactly. Now, as I alluded to, other states are doing this too. Georgia has now actually, in the Georgia Senate, they've narrowly approved an omnibus voting bill that would end no excuse absentee voting 16 years after Republicans first enacted it. It was their thing, and they have since turned against it, of course. The legislation would make a number of sweeping changes to Georgia's election code, most notably cracking down on who is eligible to vote by mail. It scraped through 29-20 in the GOP controlled Georgia Senate, which was the absolute minimum number of votes Republicans needed. Four Republicans sat out the vote, which is pretty interesting, actually. But now, instead of allowing anyone to request an absentee ballot, the bill would limit it to people who are over 65, are physically disabled, are required to be outside their voting precinct during the 3-week in-person early voting period and election day, have a religious holiday that falls on election day, work in elections, or qualify as military or overseas absentee voter. The legislation also would require voters to provide identification information such as a driver's license number, both of which they apply, both when they apply to vote by mail and when they return the ballot. And of course, we know that not everyone has a driver's license, and it is not, there's no racial equity in terms of access to that, at least in fact. And so Georgia is also getting in on it, which I see, Quay, as a slightly different thing than Iowa. I feel like there's a much more clear racial, like, they hate democracy as much as the Iowans do. But here, I feel like they've seen what a few years of success in activism by voting rights advocates. You saw black voters turn out at higher rates, and I feel like they're just not gonna have that at this point.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's almost like this kind of last gasp, right? This sort of, we need to do everything that we can because we know that we're losing voters. We know that, you know, most of the country is against us. Most of the country is more progressive or liberal than our platform tends to be. So, you know, the only way to win is to stop people from voting. And I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, if anything's un-American, it's the type of thing, again, I think if the tables were turned, if the Democrats were doing this, the Republicans would be so good at campaigning against it. They'd have a name, you know, the anti-American party. Like, they would have all of this stuff that they could say, all these talking points, all these buzzwords. And the Democrats, you know, try to play it straight for the most part. They do give the information, but they don't know how to hook, I feel like, the average, you know, not too interested voter. And not that they need to play fair politics, but I do feel like they could at least be a little bit more marketable in terms of their messaging.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, we've been talking about it for a long time here, but it clearly doesn't get people fired up. I mean, and it's disappointing. I don't know what the solution is. I don't know. And I get that, like, you know, it's hard to get people to focus on things that seem sort of abstract, like the state of democracy. But I would argue that the state of our democracy is what determines the things that are very much not abstract, like the minimum wage, like student loan debt, like access to healthcare and things like that. And so, and as always, the unfortunate thing is that we are fighting on an unequal playing field. The Republicans can just distract their voters with Dr. Seuss and stuff, because at the end of the day, they don't need to accomplish anything. They don't have many actual goals but obstruction. The left identifies things that they want to get done, and there's nothing but obstacles in the way to getting that done. And it's frustrating. And so, unfortunately for Georgia, hopefully there will be challenges to this and other laws that they're trying to pass there. Hopefully, you know, Stacey Abrams and other voting rights activists in the area will fight back against this.
Yeah, I mean, something's gotta change.
Something's gotta change. Well, things are always changing, but hopefully something good will happen at some point. Anyway, Quayles Gordon, always glad to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us. Where can people follow you for your perhaps on Twitter or something like that?
Very good. Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Aquilus. You know, I'll type it in the chat again if you don't know how to spell that. I also, if you're in the Kansas City, Lee's Summit area, I do have a small clinical practice out here. It's Headstrong Counseling. You can find it at headstrongcounseling.com.
Awesome. Basically, he takes you in the woods and you punch a tree while he criticizes you.
That's right. It's a good masculine training or something.
Exactly. Anyway, Quay, thanks as always. Talk to you soon. On the American right, you never know who's going to end up being an important member of the cast season to season. And somehow, over the past year, the MyPillow guy, Mike Lindell, has become one of the biggest stars. And I don't know much about him. I've never spoken to him, but thankfully, we do have someone who has. Friend of the show and senior Washington correspondent for Insider, Dave Leventhal, returns once again. Dave, how's it going?
Hey, it's going great, John.
Great to have you here. So you spoke with the MyPillow guy. How did this come to be? What was the context?
It's kind of an open secret in politics that if you give your name, your email address, your phone number to a political committee, that this can be information that is bought, sold, resold, rented. So I was working on a story about that, about what's going to happen going forward now that we've had some very innovative ways in which both the right and the left uses personal information of its supporters. So what does this have to do with Mike Lindell, the MyPillow guy? Well, in the course of working on this story, I was talking to a couple of Republican consultants who I've known for a long time and asking them about what they've been hearing on the Republican end. And we got talking about MyPillow and whether because of Mike Lindell, his company has sold or rented information from people who buy a MyPillow or buy some other type of product from MyPillow. And so I did what I've done many, many times in my career. Went to the website of the company, looked at its privacy policy. And John, at best, it was contradictory. And at worst, it was indicating that there were some instances in which it was selling the information. I made an inquiry to MyPillow, and lo and behold, 2 hours later, I got a phone call on my cell phone from a Minnesota area code. I thought it was spam, and lo and behold, it was actually Mike Lindell himself.
So look, I'm very glad that you were pursuing this. You know, it's bad enough that on things that are sort of explicitly political, your information could end up getting sold. Social media sites, we know, have done it in the past. The idea that that would be a thing you have to worry about when you buy a pillow online is odd. So I'm glad that you were doing the story. Would you have normally expected that the head guy in charge would so quickly respond? That doesn't, it seems like there would be a PR person or something below the MyPillow guy himself.
So for starters here, we never found any evidence that MyPillow sells its customers' information. And in the first 2 minutes of this phone call, Mike Lindell himself very clearly made the case to me that they do not sell their information. But to your question, would I expect anything like this to happen? Absolutely not. I mean, I can count probably on one hand the number of times in my career when the CEO of a large company or a significantly sizable company immediately responded to some, you know, direct in the front door media requests. So that in and of itself was odd, but the conversation, which spanned about 32 minutes, became very odd very quickly when Mike Lindell, he wasn't just responding to my inquiry. He was making threats. He was talking about getting lawyers involved. He was saying how he wanted to sue my sources, how he might sue us. It got very litigious very, very quickly. And it also kind of took this weird kind of, you know, evening sitcom term when he decided to conference into our conversation the company IT guy by the name of Todd. And then Todd decided that he was going to kind of throw the former lawyer of MyPillow under the bus, a guy by the name of Joe. And he gets conference in on the call. All of this because I was asking a question and you know, effectively read Mike Lindell what was appearing on his website, which Mike Lindell then got very upset about because he had no idea that his own company's privacy policy read this way and indicated that there was a possibility, at least as written, that one could sell or one could have their personal information sold.
So he seemed genuinely surprised by what you were describing to him.
Oh, he was shocked. He was aghast. He was just livid over the fact that this was appearing on his website, and that a plain reading of it by me or anyone else who came to this website would indicate that there was the possibility that this information would be sold, even though he said that he has never sold a single email address of anyone who's bought a MyPillow. So he wanted to make that very clear. And also, I should note too, after continuing on throughout the conversation that we had, he kind of ended it where we began by threatening lawsuits. He did at one point thank me for bringing this to his attention. And about 2 hours after we got off the phone, the MyPillow website changed. It was very clear at the top and very bold type that MyPillow does not sell its customers' information. So this clearly hit a very sensitive vein, but man, there was a whole lot of drama in between asking the question and getting the ultimate answer to this question. And one of the more fascinating conversations I've had with a political figure over the past many months, and that's saying a lot.
Sure. I mean, the bringing in the additional people, it seems like you tapped into a pre-existing conflict, I'm going to guess there. But it's really interesting because he's thankful to you for bringing it up. So far as you've acknowledged, no evidence that they've actually done this. To get so freaked out about it, it doesn't prove anything, but it feels like it does. I don't know. Anyway, I'm curious though, like you acknowledge that they changed the website a bit. Did they change the policy at all? Like the information you'd initially looked into, has that been updated as a result of this interaction?
The policy materially seems to be the same. And what seemed to be the disconnect is that they were saying that information that they would share with, for example, credit cards that were processing a MyPillow purchase or to the mail distribution companies, if you sign up for a MyPillow email list and get marketing material, they would share your information. It was being effectively presented as a sale of that information on the website. So whoever drew that up, whoever wrote it up, they might need to go to remedial writing courses or whatnot in order to get it clear. But yeah, you know, in the midst of all of this, it clearly hit a very sensitive vein.
So you said that you spoke to Mike Lindell for more than a half an hour. Did Dominion or anything related to the election come up during that time?
So as soon as we established that he was not selling the customer information from MyPillow and that he said absolutely not, this was nothing. I talked to him about Trump. I talked to him about Dominion. Why is MyPillow, why is Mike Lindell even in the news? Well, number one, going back several years, he was a tried and true supporter of Donald Trump among corporate CEOs. He was arguably the most out front across the United States as being a Trump supporter. And then in the past recent months, when Donald Trump was denying that he had lost the election, Mike Lindell was right there standing next to him. And Mike Lindell in particular had been and continues to not only cast doubt, but basically say that voting machines that were used in Georgia and in the election were tantamount to fraudulent machines and that they fixed the elections, they rigged the elections. And Mike Lindell reaffirmed that to me, that he still believes that now. And that was a couple of days before he went to CPAC, the conference, a conservative conference every year, this year held in Orlando, Florida, made an appearance and effectively said the same thing there as well. So Mike Lindell is not backing down from the notion that as far as he is concerned, the steal has not been stopped and that the election continues to be rigged and that Donald Trump should, in his opinion, be the president of the United States.
And finally, to possibly tie together the two topics, he threatened you potentially with lawsuits related to your investigation of a story not related to election fraud or anything. I know that in his pushing this idea that the entire thing was stolen, he's facing his own potential issues. And even when he's been brought on places like Newsmax, they've sometimes had to cut him off to make clear that they don't support the theories that he is pushing forward, especially in related to Dominion, because Dominion has apparently talked about some legal trouble. Did any of those potential challenges to him come up? Is he at all worried about any of the court possibilities?
Oh, well, he brought it up. We talked about it. And he at one point, I'm paraphrasing what he told me, but he said he would rather have 10 Dominion lawsuits than have his company be put out there and be presented as a company that sells the personal information of its customers. So I should also note too that Insider has not been sued. There has been no threat of a suit beyond what Mike Lindell said. There obviously is nothing to seemingly Sue over. I'm asking some questions here, which he answered. That's how journalism works. But Mike Lindell very much is under a legal cloud himself because of things that he has said about Dominion, which is a company which makes sales, which feels that its reputation has been tarred and cast adrift because of Mike Lindell's comments. So we're talking about a $1 billion+ lawsuit that Dominion has put forward. And then there's another company called Smartmatic, which is also involved in a similar way with things that Rudy Giuliani, another very tried and true Donald Trump supporter, has said too. So as much as we want to, in many ways, get beyond election 2020, it is still here with us in very real ways, John.
It is. Well, look, thank you for going through that experience and being able to bring back some interesting information on the other side. And as always, Dave, we appreciate your work.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.